I've always found the first Sunday after the first Tuesday after the first Monday of every fourth year to be an appropriate occasion for a bit of pinpricking. We need to discharge some of the excessive electricity of election hyperbole. We need to calm our own exaggerated hopes and fears. For after all, Monday's saints and sinners, the men on the white horse and the men in the red devil's mask, are today, again, our fellow citizens, our lawmakers, and our administrators. You know, it is true. In the long history of American politics, elections have rarely signaled a major reorganization of the body politic. In this century, on only one occasion, in 1932, did an election mandate a basic restructuring of the way by which we are governed. Taken as a whole, the line of the growth of American political life is remarkably steady. We've had in this century 6 changes in party administration, 11 different men as presidents. We have as a whole continued a rather steady and single-minded approach to the way in which we wish to be governed. Change in American political life tends to be piecemeal. A problem presents itself. It insists on some kind of legislation. And we devise and invent a program to meet it. Our judgments about political change tend to be taken pragmatically. Is this the best of all alternative solutions? Have we the fiscal strength with which to support the program? Do we have the staff as necessary resource? Will it work? And indeed, even the major changes of the New Deal were taken within the familiar pragmatic structure of American political life. President Roosevelt did not approach a bankrupt, installed economy with any ideological preconception, any theoretical architecture into which American life had to fit and to be crammed. Rather, he improvised as he went along specific solutions to specific problems. He and his advisors brainstormed to find the practical solutions which would give to our economy a new lease on life and a necessary new strength. We have brought to the political arena our hopes rather than our theories. Americans have not taken over from their European ancestors the European concern for political philosophy and for ideology. We tend to tinker rather than to theorize. We tend to be practical rather than to philosophize. We tend to be idealists rather than to be ideologues. There is a broadly agreed upon American dream. But there is no broadly agreed upon narrow American doctrine of government, one way and one way only, in which our national life can grow. I remember saying this to you 4 years ago this Sunday. President-elect Kennedy had spoken much during his campaign, as you recall, of new frontiers. He had an almost Rooseveltian sense of the importance of the first 100 days, and many feared that the Americans' processes would be abruptly changed and turned aside. And I suggested then that what Mr. Kennedy had in mind was a new directness rather than a new direction. That he wanted to stop the process by which political problems were being swept under any convenient rug. That he insisted upon a new vigor. A new vigorous approach, specific solutions to specific problems, but now. The time, of course, proved this to be the case. Compare, if you will, President Kennedy's assumption of office with that of the Labour government in England during the past month. Mr. Wilson has, of course, wrestled with specific economic problems, but he has also tossed into the parliamentary hopper a bill which would provide for the nationalisation of the basic units of steel production. Now, Mr. Wilson has not argued that this nationalisation is required because of any urgency in British economic life, but rather he has argued that it is right, that it is proper for the people as a whole, to own the basic units of production. Now, my point is not to argue here the theory of nationalization. Mr. Wilson may very well be right. But it's simply to suggest to you that in European politics, men theorize and they legislate according to their theory. Nationalization of steel is drawn more from the axioms of European socialism than from the practical necessities of England's present-day economic crisis. President Kennedy, 4 years ago, devised legislation to meet practical problems specifically. The Manpower Retraining Act became law because tens of thousands of men and women were out of jobs. Their jobs had been erased and canceled by automation. And they faced a lifelong breadline unless some agency of government would retrain them, provide them with new skills which had some economic value in the new labor market. The Area Redevelopments Act, the so-called Distressed Areas Bill, became law because such was the pattern of our economic growth that some areas lagged behind. They were full of obsolete plant. They were overwhelmed by a pool of unemployed labor. At the very time when they needed money for public welfare, for the retraining programs to draw in new industry, their tax base was starved and their treasuries were strapped. These areas needed some kind of federal aid. President Kennedy's method was the traditional American method of politics, problem solving, practical, pragmatic. Typical of this approach has been the proposals over the last 6 months taken by President Johnson, in which he has organized 15 task forces of citizens and experts, whom he charged each to concern itself with one of the major areas of American life: conservation, trade, labor, race relations, and the like. And he charged these groups to analyze the field given them, to review government policy, and to suggest new areas in which governmental energy might be welcome. He did not charge any of these 15 task forces to report a party line, to draw up their conclusions in a party lingo within the frame of reference of some political theory or ideology. Rather, he said, analyze and suggest, and then the administration will see what is feasible and what can be made part of our American way. Now, this process of political growth by problem solving is our way, but is of course the bane of ideologues of all stripes. It's not very neat. And those who need to cram life under some convenient label before they feel secure and at ease never know what to make of the American economy. It's part free, part regulated. We call ourselves a free enterprise economy, but of course we know that large segments of the economy belong to the welfare state and the socialist state also. The test for us, of course, is, does it work? And the answer is that so far it has worked, and worked well. And so we shrug off the taunts and the damning of the ideologues of statism, of central control, who say that what we are doing is only palliative, not enough. We shrug off the damning of the disciples and dogmatists of free enterprise who say that what we are achieving is some form of creeping socialism. The test for us is not the label, but the effect. And the proof of the pudding lies in the prosperity, the decency, and the dignity of American life. And so it is that the Manpower Retraining Act, the Area Developments Bill, and all of the companion legislation of the last administration, the extension of coverage under the minimum wage, the various housing and slum clearance programs, the farm subsidy bills which were continued, the Small Business Administration Act, all of these and their like gave us 4 years of unrivaled prosperity. We did make some inroads on the gray areas of the economy. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. For us, the proof of our national life is in its success. And to judge that success, I would remind you that 4 years ago, when the Kennedy administration was about to assume office, 5.5 million Americans were unemployed. Economists freely predicted that 2 million more of our American citizens would be unemployed within 6 months. We had just stumbled through 2 recessions in the last 3.5 years. 100,000 American citizens were exhausting their qualifications for unemployment insurance and public relief each month. And there seemed to be danger that the American economy was truly grinding to a halt. I say this as preamble to the suggestion that the mandate which President Johnson received Tuesday last was essentially this, that we asked him to continue this pragmatic and practical and reasonable approach to politics. He is faced with a revolutionary age. He is faced with new demands, new stresses and strains in our way of life and our economy. And we asked him to continue this traditional pragmatic approach. We didn't want a major reorientation, major restructuring of our way. We didn't want an ideology. We did not want any philosophic preconception, any corset, any straitjacket into which American life had to be crammed. Rather, we wanted specific solutions to specific problems as these arose. What these specific solutions will be, indeed what the specific problems of the next 4 years will be, remains hidden from us by the mists of time. In all probability, the first years of the new administration will be spent in consolidation, in understanding what has already been achieved, for the major bills of the Kennedy administration became law only in the last months of the Johnson administration, and we have yet to explore, to understand, and indeed to put into effect their major provisions. There is, for instance, the exciting Economics Opportunity Act of 1964. So-called poverty bill. This act is a first major statement by the federal government of its concern for remedial education, for the employment of youth, to enrich the land of starvation, the gray area of the city slum and of the city sidewalk, with manpower, with organization, with all that which can reach down in and help these deprived young people to come to a rightful place within our American prosperity. The Economic Opportunities Act was designed to be a cooperative effort between the communities and the federal government. The communities were to draw up a suggestion of programs, local programs, tailored to their own needs. And then these are to be approved by the Poverty Bill Administrator. Cleveland has just 2 months ago submitted to Washington our preliminary proposals. And these are wide-ranging and far-reaching. We proposed an adult high school, adult illiteracy classes, work training in and out of school, preschool education centers, sufficient funds so that our school buildings can be open day and night for children and adults alike, as enrichment centers and leisure time agencies. We asked for money to train the handicapped in sheltered workshops. We asked for money to reach out with counseling and housekeeping aid, to free the deprived homes so that the individuals in these homes can go to school and stay in school, and when necessary, go to work to provide advanced education for the young. All this was asked and more. But this is still a paper program. We have yet to see the first results, the first building. In all probability, President Johnson will wait until these programs have had some years to develop before he asks for new legislation in this particular area. What will be demanded of him is efficient administration, energetic administration. Will be demanded of him not only by the this will be demanded of him not only by the poverty bill, but by the civil rights bill which passed Congress last year. The paper dragon of the last election was a so-called white backlash. Many Americans may not enjoy the frustration of getting over their inherited prejudices, but most Americans are of sufficient dignity to want an open and an equal society. And they said so by their vote in overwhelming numbers at the polls. And what they insist on now on the part of our federal government is a vigorous administration of the rights guaranteed by law and by the Constitution. The right to vote, opportunity in housing, opportunity in employment, and the like. We said by our vote on Tuesday last, we are not only indignant at the continuing violence in Mississippi, the burnings and the racial murders which go unpunished. We are indignant with the outrage at our own back door, that which keeps some men from being our neighbors, that which divides a city, half white and half Negro, that which divides the city from the suburb and the suburb from the city. We are determined that employment opportunities shall be open to all, that there shall no longer be closed racial shops within unions, that we are determined that our neighborhoods shall be open to all, that there shall no longer be racial covenants, restrictive barriers against those who wish to live near us and among us. We said, too, that we will somehow find within our hearts not only understanding and tolerance, but sympathy. The urgency of Negro demands will bridle our tongues and our occasional frustration at Negro strategy if we disapprove of a particular program. And we will see to it that we do not lend aid and comfort to the bigot. And what we demand of the federal government, it's effective, vigorous enforcement of the laws which are now on the books. I look to the next years as years of growth and of consolidation. I think they will be good years. The last 12 months have seen the American people mobilize its own decency in law and in vote, and make clear, patently clear, to those in control of government where we wish our society to go, where it has always been destined to go, towards goodness, towards openness, towards the decency which each man owes to his neighbor. And the test of the next years will then be both on the administration and on the citizen. For increasingly, the programs which have been devised by the federal government depend upon a local base of support, local initiative, and local willingness. Cleveland must see to it that the poverty bill becomes an effective tool against poverty here in the city. The government will provide the money. We must provide the manpower, the morality, the determination. What stands in our way? What stands in our way as we begin a new administration? Very little. We're an abundant, prosperous nation. Our strength is unrivaled. We can easily accept our present population and far more. What stands in our way? only our own political preconceptions. I'm afraid that whatever be our place in the political spectrum, a little bit of Senator Goldwater rubbed off on each of us. Each of us is tending to bring to the political arena his own particular brand of ideology, of political presupposition. Tell us that a bill is sponsored by a senator of the left, and we immediately damn it without knowing its contents. Tell us that a bill is supported by a particular senator of the right, and another group of Americans immediately damn its contents. Once upon a time, a bill proposed in the legislature was debated on its merits. But frankly, this debate has been largely absent in our American life. We have been a nation of labelers, liberal, conservative, extremist, moderate, red, black, pink. We've accepted for ourselves, I'm afraid, also some of these political pigeonholes, these political labels. I've seen on many of your own library tables, one or another of these carefully drawn up sheets which show how each member of the federal legislature voted on each bill and which rates these votes according to some assumed absolute standard of Americanism. And these sheets are not only drawn up by the extremist lunatic fringe in American life. Most of us have come to assume in one way or another that there is an American way, a single way and only way for government to act, and that any deviation from this assumed norm, which is really our own hypostasized prejudice, that any deviation from this assumed norm is almost heretic. No, I am not speaking now of the extremist. The extremist deserves a sermon of his own. His world is a world of the paranoid. He's psychopathic. He is dangerous, to be sure. I'm speaking of us, you and I, the way in which we are approaching our political problems. None of us would willingly lend aid and comfort to the segregationist. But let the segregationist suggest that there is a constitutional issue, states' rights involved in the Civil Rights Bill, and how many are tempted to join the enemy camp. How many of us remember in making our political decisions what Justice Holmes once said, that America is an experiment, not a conclusion. The American Constitution is a guideline for growth, not a party line from which no deviation is ever permitted. And none of us would willingly go in to deny to the worker his right to unionize. Collective bargaining has brought dignity and a high standard of living and decency to a wide range of the American working class. But let the fat cats of the NAM argue that there is a constitutional issue, an American issue, the right to vote, to work. How many of us join with them in arguing for their special and venal self-interest? How many of us remember that America is an experiment, not a conclusion? That the Constitution provides guidelines for growth, not a party line, not a party line, from which no deviation is permitted. And none of us would willingly tolerate irresponsibility in government or irresponsibility in labor or irresponsibility in management or irresponsibility in the farming community. But let any of these vested interests argue that government regulation is an arbitrary interference in the mechanics of a free enterprise. How many of us are tempted to agree that their special interests, their vested concerns are somehow sacrosanct and above regulation? All of us, I'm afraid, have been guilty these past years of judging by labels, of assuming that there is a single way. The Constitution provides a very narrow highway, which we must walk carefully along, never to the right or to the left, but only one step ahead of the other. Free enterprise is one of these dangerous, wonderful, exciting, misleading words. True and yet false, false and yet true. In a pristine sense, free enterprise has never existed in the American economy. The very first bill passed by a constitutional Congress was a tariff bill, an arbitrary intrusion of government policy in the marketplace. And since that first bill, we have interfered to protect the businessman, and then to perfect the laboring man, and then to protect the farmer, and finally to protect the consumer. And whenever we have interfered in the mechanisms of free enterprise of the marketplace, we have done so because a community requires regulations, because city streets require traffic lights, because the weak require protection from the strong, because some measure of protection allows a society to grow and to progress, to become something more than the indecency of the jungle. American life has grown because Americans as a whole have been anti-ideologues, anti-philosophic in their approach to government, because we came to government without preconception. And strangely, this is also the Jewish way. Our people have been governed through the long centuries by a remarkable variety of political organizations. We have had tribal confederation. We've been governed by kings. We've been governed by oriental despots. We've had a theocracy. We've had an aristocracy of the learned. We've had a vague, rudimentary town hall kind of democracy in the shtetl. And finally, Israel today is a socialist democracy. Our tradition has never made any one form of political organization sacrosanct. We have never refined any dogmatic of political theory. Rather, our tradition has insisted for ab initio, from the first, that is not the form of government so much as the way of, in which the government exerts its authority. And we have concentrated on the goals, on righteousness, on justice, on the broadest quality of freedom, on the establishment of peace, on the establishment of institutions which promote the decency of men, which promote education and learning and leisure, all these and more. Judaism has never insisted that each generation confine itself to some ideal preconception of what government must be. We have never had a Plato who drew for us an ideal state, its ideal laws, its ideal rulers, the philosopher kings, and then who argued that all life must somehow be crammed into this one artificial construct of his own mind. Our prophets, our rabbis insisted rather that whatever be the form of government deemed best in that age, that government must reflect the basic moral law, these Ten Commandments, and more. And that is the judgment by which we judge the propriety of law and authority. I read to you this morning from Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived during the days of the kings of Israel. He knew of monarchy. He judged monarchy in terms as you shall hear. But we might apply this judgment equally to an oligarchy, to an aristocracy, to a democracy. This is the final judgment, the final test which we must impose on any government. Thus saith the Lord, go down to the house of the king of Judah and speak there these words. Execute justice and righteousness, and deliver the spoiled out of the hand of the oppressor, and do no wrong, do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow. Shed not innocent blood in this place. If ye do these things, then there shall enter in by these gates kings sitting upon the throne of Israel. If ye will not hear these words, I swear, saith the Lord, that this palace shall become a desolation. And what did the framers of our own basic organization of life say? Their language is the language of the Bible. in order to promote a more perfect union, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and to secure the blessings of liberty. This is the biblical dream. This is the American dream. This is the biblical way, and this is the American way. High goals, strict demands of righteousness placed upon those in authority, whatever be the form of their authority, their ultimate responsibility is to the moral law. With this, there is no compromise. With the forms by which a society is determined to organize its life, there can be debate. It is up to the ingenuity and to the wisdom of each age. But with the fundamental purpose of government, there can be no debate. So let's put aside for the next 4 years all of these ideological preconceptions. All of these American first kinds of terms which have begun to clutter up our thinking. And let's look again at the world of men. Let's look again at our cities, at the gray world of poverty, the slum, the cold sidewalk, and the black world of discrimination and of prejudice, where men are locked out from the sun. And let's not argue philosophic theory and on that Empyrean height fail to see the broken lives and the stunted growth and the need. Let's look at our society and ask what is demanded to make it even a better society and a finer place for the children of men. This is the proper question. And as we ask it and answer it, as the president asks it, provides answers to it, we will find in it again the steadying American dynamic of growth, that which has brought us to this height, that which will permit us to grow yet from strength to strength. Amen.